Hey everyone, welcome back to Japan Archives, episode 56. Now, we said this week we were going to do another folktale, because it had been a few months, definitely a few weeks since we did the last one, and we were going to pick the one called The Tongue-Cut Sparrow. Is this a story you've heard before, Heather? It must be, surely.
It must be. I feel like once you start telling it, it'll ring some bells. Not bells of Midera, but some bells. But I know we've talked about this one before, several times, just in conversations between the two of us. So I'm hoping that it's familiar, but also I like new stuff as well. So I'm good with both.
Okay, fair enough. But you're doing all right. I know, but just before we started recording, you said you had a bit of snow down where you are. We're still okay up in Tokyo.
Yeah, we actually had snow and it covered the ground a little bit, as opposed to the flurries we've been having for the past couple of weeks. And it disappeared by mid-morning, so which is the good snow. It didn't make the road, didn't stick on the roads. It looked really pretty, and then it went bye-bye. I was going to ask, how are you?
I'm doing well. Like we said when we were having that break, I was going to, you know, concentrate on getting the jobs. I've started hearing back from them, so hopefully I will get a new job soon. Anyway, today I'm going to read the story from a book that I have. You know, it's a folk tale. It's been around for a while. There's no need to rewrite it, I don't think. This one comes from a female author called Yei Theodora Ozaki, and she translated these into English all the way back in 1908.
Ooh.
I feel, before we start that, we've been saying it a lot lately, things being translated from Japanese into English, sometimes maybe the meanings get not corrupted or changed or interpreted differently. So in this book, she addresses the sparrow as a female sparrow.
Hmm.
But going back to one of our previous episodes, Kettles and Sparrows, where we talked about the sparrow's wedding, there was a little sparrow in there called Ozume. And she, in that story, it didn't click with me at first when I read it, so I didn't include it. But after rereading this story, it clicked in my brain. In that old story, it says that she was the daughter of a male sparrow who was the tongue-cut sparrow. So these two stories are linked in a way. She, in that story, is the daughter of the father from this one. However, in this translated telling, she addresses the sparrow as female. So whether she changed the gender, or I'm not really sure what happened, or maybe there are different versions, or maybe even in the Japanese, there is no gender given, which could be possible. You just use they or it, as it is a sparrow, and she added the female element in English. I'm not too sure. But yeah, not in other versions, but at least in other stories that link to this one, it does say that this sparrow in particular was a male sparrow. Let's start, shall we? Long, long ago, mukashi mukashi, there lived an old man and his wife. The old man was a good, kind-hearted, and hard-working old fellow. But his wife was a regular crosspatch who spoiled the happiness of her home by her scolding tongue. She was always grumbling about something from morning to night. The old man had for a long time ceased to take any notice of her. He was out most of the day at work in the fields, and as he had no child, for his amusement when he came home, he kept a tame sparrow. He loved the little bird just as much as if it had been his own child. When he came back at night, after his hard day's work in the open air, it was his only pleasure to pet the sparrow, to talk to her and to teach her little tricks, which she learnt very quickly. The old man would open her cage and let her fly about the room, and they would play together. Then, when supper time came, he always saved some tidbits from his meal, which he then fed to the little bird. Now, one day, the old man went out to chop wood in the forest, and the old woman stopped at home to wash clothes. The day before, she had made some starch, and now, when she came to look for it, it was all gone. The bowl, which she had filled full yesterday, was quite empty. While she was wondering who could have used or stolen it, down flew the pet sparrow, and bowing her little feathered head, a trick which he had been taught by the old man, the pretty bird chirped and said, "It is I who have taken the starch. I thought it was some food put out for me in that basin, and I ate it all. If I had made a mistake, I beg you to forgive me. Tweet, tweet, tweet." You see from this that the sparrow was a truthful bird, and the old woman ought to have had been willing to forgive her at once when she asked her pardon so nicely. But of course this was not so. The old woman had never loved the sparrow, and had often quarreled with her husband for keeping what she called a dirty little bird about the house, saying that it only made extra work for her. Now she was only too delighted to have some cause of complaint against the pet. She scolded and even cursed the poor little thing for her bad behavior, and not content with using these harsh, unfeeling words, in a fit of rage she seized the sparrow, who all this time had spread out her wings and bowed her head before the old woman, to show how sorry she had been. The old woman fetched a pair of scissors and cut off the poor bird's little tongue. I suppose you took the starch with that tongue. Now you may see what it is like to go without it. And with these dreadful words, she drove the bird away, not caring in the least what might have happened to it, and without the smallest pity for its suffering. The old woman, after she had driven it away, made some more rice paste, grumbling all the time at the trouble, and after starching all the clothes, spread the things on boards to dry in the sun, instead of ironing them as they do in England. In the evening, the old man came home. As usual on the way back, he looked forward to the time when he could reach his gate and see his pet come flying and chirping to meet him, ruffling out her feathers to show her joy, and at last coming to rest on his shoulder. But tonight he found himself very disappointed, for not even the shadow of his dear sparrow was to be seen. He quickened his steps, hastily drew off his straw sandals and stepped onto the veranda. Still no sparrow was to be seen. He now felt sure that his wife, in one of her cross tempers, had shut the sparrow in its cage, so he called her and said anxiously, "Where is Suzume-san?" The old woman pretended not to know at first and answered, "Your sparrow? I'm sure I don't know. Now, to come to think of it, I haven't seen her all afternoon. I shouldn't wonder if the ungrateful bird had flown away and left you after all your petting." But at last, when the old man gave her no peace, but asked her again and again, insisting that she must know what had happened to his pet, she confessed everything. She told him crossly how the sparrow had eaten the rice paste, and she had specifically made it to starch the clothes, and how when the sparrow had confessed to what she had done, in great anger, she had taken the scissors to cut out its tongue, and after that, she had driven it away. Then the old woman showed her husband the sparrow's tongue, saying, "Here is the tongue I cut off. Horrid little bird, why did it eat all of my starch?" "How could you be so cruel?" the old man said. He was too kind-hearted to punish his shrew of a wife, but he was terribly distressed at what had happened with his poor little pet. "What a dreadful misfortune for my poor Suzume-san to lose her tongue. She won't be able to chirp any more, and surely the pain of cutting it off in that rough way must have made her quite ill. Is there nothing to be done?" The old man shed many tears then after his cross wife had gone to sleep. While he wiped away the tears with the sleeve of his cotton robe, a bright thought comforted him. He would go and look for her in the morning. Having decided this, he was able to go to sleep at last. The next morning he rose early. As soon as ever the day broke, and snatching a hasty breakfast, started out over the hills and through the woods, stopping at every clump of bamboo to cry, "Where, oh where, does my tongue-cut sparrow stay? Where, oh where, is she?" He never stopped to rest for his noonday meal, and it was far in the afternoon when he found himself near a large bamboo wood. Bamboo groves are the favourite haunts of sparrows, and there, sure enough, at the edge of the wood, he saw his own dear sparrow waiting to welcome him. He could hardly believe his eyes for joy, and ran forward quickly to greet her. She bowed her little head and went through a number of her tricks her master taught her to show her pleasure at seeing her old friend again, and wonderful to relate she could talk of as old. The old man told her how sorry he was for everything that had happened, and inquired after her tongue, wondering how she could speak so well without it. Then the sparrow opened her beak and showed that a new tongue was there, and had grown in place of the old one, and begged him not to think about it any more, for she was quite well now. Then the old man knew that this sparrow was a fairy, and no common bird. It would be difficult to exaggerate the old man's rejoicing. He forgot all his troubles. He even forgot how tired he was, for he had found his lost sparrow, and instead of being ill and without a tongue, as he had feared and expected to find her, she was well and happy with her new chung, and without a sign of ill treatment she had received from his wife. And above all of this, she was a fairy. The sparrow asked him to follow her, and flying before him, she led him to a beautiful house in the heart of a bamboo grove. The old man was utterly astonished, and when he entered the house, he found it to be a very beautiful place. It was built of the whitest wood. The soft cream-coloured mats which took the place of carpets were the finest he had ever seen, and the cushions that the sparrow brought out for him to sit on were made of the finest silk and crepe. Beautiful vases and lacquer boxes adorned every room. The sparrow led the old man to the place of honour, and then taking her place at a humble distance, she thanked him with many polite bows for all the kindness he had showed her for many long years. Then the Lady Sparrow, as we will now call her, introduced all her family to the old man. This done, her daughters, robed in dainty crepe gowns, brought in on beautiful old-fashioned trays a feast of all delicious kinds of food, till the old man began to think he must be dreaming. In the middle of the dinner, some of the sparrow's daughters performed a wonderful dance called the Suzume Odori to amuse their guests. Never had the old man enjoyed himself so much. The hours flew by too quickly in this lovely spot, with all these fairy sparrows to wait upon him, and to feast him, and to dance before him. But the night came on, and the darkness reminded him that he had a long way to go, and must think about taking his leave and return home. He thanked his kind hostess for her splendid entertainment, and begged her for his sake to forget all that had suffered at the hands of his cross wife. He told the Lady Sparrow that it was a great comfort and happiness to him to find her in such a beautiful home, and to know that she wanted for nothing. It was his anxiety to know how she fared and what had really happened to her that had led him to seek her. Now he knew that all was well, and he could return home with a light heart. If ever she wanted him for anything, she had only to send for him, and he would come at once. Lady Sparrow then begged him to stay and rest for several days and enjoy the change. But the old man said he must return to his old wife, who would still probably be cross at him for not coming home at the usual time. But now that he knew where the Lady Sparrow lived, he would come to see her whenever he had the time. And so, with the old man leaving, Lady Sparrow ordered some of her servants to bring two boxes to him, one large and one small. These were placed before the old man, and the Lady Sparrow asked him to choose whichever he liked as a gift. The old man could not refuse this kind proposal, and he chose the smaller, saying, "I am too old and feeble to carry the big and heavy box. As you are so kind as to say that I may take whichever, I will choose this one, for it will be much easier for me to carry." Then the sparrows all helped him put it on his back, and he went, and they all went to the gate to see him off, bidding him goodbyes with many bows, and entreating him to come again whenever he had the time. Thus the old man and his pet sparrow separated quite happily. When the old man finally reached home, he found his wife even crosser than usual, for it was very late in the night, and she had been waiting up for him for quite a while. "Where have you been all this time?" she asked in her big voice. "Why do you come back so late?" The old man tried to pacify her by showing her the box of presents he had brought back, and then he told her of everything that had happened, and how wonderfully he had been entertained at the sparrow's house. "Now let us see what is in this box," he said. "You must help me open it." And they both sat down before the box. To their utter astonishment, they found it filled to the brim with gold and silver and many other precious things. The mats of their little cottage fairly glittered as they took out the things one by one and put them down and handed them over and over again. The old man was overjoyed at the sight of the riches. Beyond his brightest expectations was the sparrow's gift, which would enable him to give up work and live in ease and comfort until the end of his days. He thanked his little sparrow, saying, thank you, my good little sparrow, many times over. But the old woman, after the first moments of surprise and satisfaction at the sight of everything, could not suppress the greed of her wicked nature. She now began to reproach the old man for not having brought home the big box, for in the innocence of his heart he had told her how he had refused the larger of the two gifts. "You silly old man," she said, "why did you not bring the large one? Just think of what we have lost. We might have had twice as much treasure as we have now. You are certainly an old fool. The old man now wished he had said nothing about it, but it was too late. The greedy old woman, not content with the good luck they had been given, wanted more. Early the next morning, she got up and made the old man describe the way to the sparrow's home. And when she had been given the directions, she proceeded to find her way there. After walking for some hours, the old woman had at last found this bamboo grove, for which she had made her husband describe ever so carefully so she didn't get lost. "Where is the tongue-cut sparrow's house?" she cried. At last she saw the eaves of the house, peeping out from amongst the bamboo foliage. She hastened to the door and knocked loudly. When the servants told Lady Sparrow of who was at the door, she was somewhat surprised at the unexpected visit. After all that had taken place, she wondered not a little at the boldness of the old woman in venturing to come to this house. However, Lady Sparrow was quite a polite bird, and so she invited the old woman in. The old woman intended, however, to waste no time in words. She went right to the point, without the least bit of shame, saying, "You need not trouble to entertain me as you did my old man. I have come to get the box which he so stupidly left behind. I shall soon take my leave, if you will give me this box. It's all I want." Lady Sparrow immediately consented, and told her servants to bring out the big box. The old woman eagerly seized it and hoisted it on her back, and without even stopping to thank her, the old woman hurried home. The box was so heavy she could not walk fast, let alone run. So anxious she was to get home and see what was inside the box, but she had often to sit down and rest. While she was staggering along under the heavy load, her desire to open it became too great to resist, for she supposed the big box was to be full of golden treasures just like the previous one. And so this greedy and selfish woman put down the box on the wayside and opened it carefully, expecting to gloat her eyes on a mine of wealth. What she saw, however, so terrified her that she nearly lost her senses. Under the lid, a number of horrible and frightful-looking demons bounced out of the box and surrounded her as if they intended to kill her. Not even in nightmares had she seen such horrible things. A demon with one huge right eye in the middle of its forehead came and glared at her. Monsters with gaping mouths looked as if they would devour her. A huge snake coiled and hissed about her, and a big frog hopped and croaked towards her. The old woman had never been so frightened in her life, and ran from the spot as quick as she could. When she reached home, she fell to the floor and told her husband with tears all that had happened to her, and how she had nearly been killed by the demons in the box. Then she began to blame the sparrow, but the old man stopped her at once, saying, "Don't blame the little sparrow. It is your wickedness which has at last met with its reward. I only hope this may be a lesson to you in the future." The old woman said nothing more, and from that day she repented of her cross, unkindly ways, and by degrees became a good old woman, so that her husband hardly knew her to be the same person. And they spent their last days together happily, free from want or care, spending carefully the treasure the old man had received from his pet, the tongue-cut sparrow.
I'm a little familiar with that story, but I thought it had a different ending.
Maybe you heard a different version then.
Yeah, I like this one where I don't like the fact that she cut the poor sparrow's tongue. It's pretty horrific. But the fact that she changed and repented and became a better person, actually actively became a better person, that was not expected. I was not expecting to have that ending.
What happened in the version that you heard then?
I thought the old woman got her tongue cut out.
Ooh, that's a dark version. Kind of reminds me of the Grimm fairy tale.
Yeah, so I'm wondering if it's something I've might have mixed up with something else, perhaps, or who knows. So I'm familiar with the sparrow's tongue being cut, but I thought that, yeah. So I like this much better. I mean, I still don't like the poor sparrow being hurt, but I do like the fact that, you know, the sparrow was okay. The sparrow was actually a fairy, and also the old woman learned the error of her ways. And the old man got to see his friend again, and then got to have a happy life together with his wife for the end of their days. It's turned into a very uplifting story.
And This is one of the sometimes Japanese fairy tales, sometimes what my friends have said, like Tessa, she has read some of these and she thinks that the moral is skewed or it doesn't work as well as fairy tales in English. But this one seems to does have an obvious moral, which is, you know, don't be greedy.
Yeah, don't hurt people or animals, and be forgiving and accepting, and yeah, don't be selfish and greedy. Yeah, you're right too, because we've even read some like folk tales that we were like, is there a meaning here? We weren't quite sure if there was something, but
a bit like Momotaro, what was the moral of that one? Like, he grew up strong, he killed some oni, he was kind of mean to the animals that helped him as well, which I didn't expect. I couldn't figure out the moral of that one. It's like, treat people horribly, you'll still get everything you want. I'm assuming that was not the moral of Momotaro.
Maybe that was more of like an epic, like a hero's journey type thing, as opposed to a moral story.
But no, definitely in this one, I could get the moral almost instantly.
Yeah, it's surprising. And to have a happy ending again. Like, sometimes I expect with folk tales or folk tales or like mythological tales to sometimes have a neutral ending, or sometimes we would perceive more as a negative ending, but this one seemed very positive,
which is good.
I'm also noticing, I feel like I've said this before, I probably have, but the cobwebs in my brain, we run into stories, it seems, sometimes where it's the wife or the woman who is a negative kind of symbol, and the man or the husband is usually like kind and generous and good. And I do know this can be also a theme in Western fairy tales, where you have, you know, the wicked stepmother. Hansel and Gretel comes to mind, you know, Cinderella comes to mind, Snow White comes to mind. But we have run into ones, I think, where the father is kind of a more strict, negative seeming character, haven't we? Or have I read things before where the father is like very strict? Or have we?
No, I'm just looking at my list of fairy tales in the book of Ozaki-san. And just looking through the names of them all, because I've read most of them, like, none of them jump out at me as, oh, the male character in it is the antagonist. Hmm. So it seems to be an interesting trope all around the world, really. And I do wonder why that is.
Yeah, I feel like it was one of those things I studied about in college a couple years ago, but completely gone from my recollection, like, where there's the different like archetypes, is it, where you have either the it's not Virgin and Madonna, I forget what it's called, like, for women you generally have these two archetype categories, that you're either in this category or you're in this category, you're either Snow White or you're the queen.
Okay, there's no middle ground.
From my recollection of this conversation I had a couple years back, yes, where these universal themes, which we are seeing here in some of these stories that we found. Ah, okay. So it's definitely kind of more common across cultures. Yeah. Hmm. And that brings you to a whole new topic that goes way deeper. I do feel like people who have studied literature more extensively than I studied a little bit, but not to the depth and breadth that would be appropriate for this topic. So I may be delving into some waters here that I might need little paddles for, little swim fins.
Well, it's definitely an interesting image that you conjured. Next time we come back to folktales, we'll have to see again if it does repeat. Maybe it won't. Maybe we'll eventually stumble on one where it is the opposite, or maybe, if you at home know of a Japanese story that is, well, Japanese folktale, where for once the man is the antagonist, let us know. Contact us through the website. That would be very good.
Oh, and even Western stories as well. I like, you know, all genres of all international stories, not just Western. We have whole wide globe. Any story from anywhere, just share it, because we like learning about different parts of the world too, not just Japan.
That's very true. Thank you for saying that. Yeah, that's all I really have to say for the story. I didn't think we would get much discussion from it, but we did, so I'm very happy about that. I'm very intrigued to see if you found something themed for today, or you just found an interesting poet and poem for today. What you got?
I got a theme. I found a theme. So we have a poem about a swallow.
Ooh, okay.
I found more than one. And I found a few from Basho, but this is not from Basho. The one I wanted from Basho, I couldn't seem to locate. So that one I'm putting on my list to see if I can find it in a book somewhere and bring it back. Because I found it on a website where the author said that the translations and things were for personal private use only for your own haiku studies. So I wanted to respect, you know, her wishes, or maybe it might have been a guy. I wanted to respect the author's wishes to not talk about it on the podcast. So I have to go and find this poem in another source, but it's in my list. It's in my radar. And it's Basho. Apparently Basho had a few swallow poems.
Okay.
I don't have Basho, but I have Takurai Kikaku, who was a follower of Basho. And does that name ring any bells to you?
One moment. It does. It does. Yes. We've done him before.
Yes, we have. Do you remember? I have the episode up right here, actually, because when I realized, I was like, wait a minute, we've done him before. And I searched historyofjapan.co.uk to verify my findings. And sure enough, it's in the show notes. So we have a poem we've talked about, the poet before. And again, it's in the show notes, historyofjapan.co.uk. Search for episode 35, Light Returns, and you can find the information about the poet there. Not only that, but I found this poem on it's actually comes from the Met. So it's the Met Museum, because there is also art with this poem, and it's Bird and Flower Prince from Utagawa Hiroshige.
I do know of him. I'm interested, what came first, the poem or the art? So is the poem based off the art, or is the art based off the poem?
The art was done circa 1835, and and Takurai Kikaku lived from 1661 to 1707.
Okay, so poem came first.
And it's a woodblock print, and it's beautiful. So it's got the poem on the print itself. And I will include that in the show notes as well, so we can properly cite it. And also, I believe the picture itself might be in the public domain. So I have a poem and I have a woodblock print. So I'm excited, because we have art, we have poetry, we have literature. You know, if we had music to go along with it, this would just be like
even better.
So I'm going to do something, you know, a tiny bit different. I took the poem and for fun, I put it into Google Translate, because I want you to hear the meaning of what happens when I put it into Google Translate. We do also have from the website, there is a translation as well. So we'll go over that so that we can also verify from Thomas what you think the poem says. So we have a couple different interpretations here. One that's definitely more correct than the other one. The other one's just funny, and I'm reading it because it's hilarious to me. So if you're ready, I will go. Yama no hani, subame o kaesu, irihi kana.
Well, subame is swallow. I know that much Japanese. The yama, I'm going to assume, is mountain. Yama no ha. Is this like the peaks of the mountains?
Yeah, I think you're actually pretty close there.
My logic here, so bear with me. Yama no ha, ha made me think teeth. And teeth made me think of like, it's the end, which made me think of a mountain point. It's a weird logic, but that's how I got there. And then ni is a particle for direction. So it's like the swallow is going to the mountain top, but the rest of it, I don't know.
I love that you mentioned the teeth. I mean, the kanji, I'm not familiar with this kanji. I'll flat out tell you this one. I don't know. But you got to the meaning because the translation here on the site says, the setting sun over the mountain ridge sends the swallows home. So you were on to something with the teeth. So teeth, ridge, like point.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you got the, I love that. You got the meaning from that. That's phenomenal.
I got the wrong word for ha, but I somehow got the same, similar meaning.
I love that. That's fantastic. And I have to read the Google Translate version. It gave me three different translations. And I had to put line by line. And the translation is, at the edge of the mountain, squeeze a bird. Is it coming to Japan?
I'm trying not to laugh right now, okay? I tried so hard.
And I
squeeze the swallow. Squeeze it. Oh, no.
No, Google Translate.
Yeah, it's so stupid.
How?
What fresh hell is that?
I think Gaiatsu is like to return home, to go back. But how? I don't even know where they got. Is it coming to Japan?
Yeah, Japan is not in there. Also,
no.
Squeezing. Where did the squeezing come from?
I don't know. I don't know. But they got the edge of the mountain. So that was that they got something.
So, well.
So yeah, that seems more like a sinew than a haiku. It's horrible. It's horrible. In both meaning and in action, because no, please don't squeeze a bird. Please don't. Unless it's a squeaky bird toy that you're playing with your cat. That's the only bird you really should be squeezing. It's a cat toy. Plastic or fuzzy cat toy that has a squeaker in it.
Now, I also thought I would quickly see what squeeze, the verb to squeeze, is in Japanese. And it keeps coming up as shiboru. And shiboru is definitely not in this poem. So I really don't know where it came from.
Mm-mm. No, no.
I'm still trying to not think about it because it's so stupid. Okay.
So we'll go back to the original meaning of the haiku,
yes.
Which this is a haiku, by the way.
Please read the original again, because I've forgotten after that horrible rendition.
The setting sun over the mountain ridge sends the swallows home.
That is a much nicer version.
Much, much, much more beautiful. It goes very well with the woodblock print. I mean, even the woodblock print itself seems to give that feeling of sparrows returning home at sunset. Please listen to this definition and look at the woodblock print. The Google Translate is just for your own amusement and for ours. And also, a reminder, don't use Google Translate to translate poetry.
Well, apart from Google Translate, thank you for all of that.
You are so welcome. And I'm we're now going to have to add this artist into a possible topic for the future, because I would love to look more into his art. This is really beautiful. So, and we do like the woodblock prints. So hopefully sometime we can look at this one as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we've had a few other suggestions as well from people, especially Pokemon right now.
Oh.
So we've been asking for Pokemon and how they relate to creatures or things that come from Japan, like the gods or the yokai and things like that, which would be an interesting topic. You can thank Alfredo for that. We also still need to do the one from one of our listeners who messaged us on Instagram about looking into the death rituals surrounding Buddhism. So yeah, we have death rituals, Pokemon.
I'm interested. Like, I had never thought about the Pokemon reference, and now that is all I'm going to think about.
I was thinking, oh, there's only one. I could only think of Ninetales because it was the obvious one off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But then I got sent an article about all the Pokemon that are based off things. So we're going to have to do more than one about this probably. And it was interesting. It was interesting. I guess it's time for us to sign off for today. Oh, isn't next week a Heather episode? That's exciting. Potential Heather episode.
Potential culinary history episode. I'm hoping to talk about the history of noodles. So that is our current goal, but it possibly could be a Thomas
episode.
There was flashing lights outside, so I got distracted. So yeah, next week could be either culinary history or next week could be something from Thomas, yet to be determined. So we'll let you know next week. You'll find out the same as us when we go live.
As often with this show, you know, we'll tell you what's coming and probably it gets pushed back a week or two, but you know, you're still here, you're still listening, you're used to that by now, so thanks for sticking around with us.
Thank you so much.
But anyway, thank you for everyone for tuning in today. Show notes, as usual, up on our website, historyofjapan.co.uk or japanarchivespodcast.com. They redirect to the same place. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Japan Archives, or follow my Instagram at nexus_travels to see some of the places I explore around in Japan. But apart from that, that is definitely everything from me today. How about you, Heather?
That's all for me.
All right, that's all, folks. So until next week, またね。
皆さん気をつけて、またね。